It's a small world. Events today in Europe, Asia, and Africa will all have an impact here in the U.S. From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's the Marketplace Midday Update. Our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Thursday, October 20th. Coming up, floods in Thailand could throw cold water on the economy, and Microsoft's opening new stores, and they look kind of familiar. Plus, a how-to on making a stronger middle class. Those stories ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
We'll start this morning with news out of Africa, Libya to be precise. Reports are coming in that Muammar Gaddafi has been captured and may be killed in the town of Sirte. The Obama administration is working to confirm those reports. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has been following the story for us, and he joins us now to talk about it. Hi, Mitchell.
Hi, Jeremy.
So I assume that oil is where we should start looking for economic implications.
Well, yeah. You know, when I was in Cairo back in February, it was pretty clear that any major conflict breaking out next door in Libya was going to cause a lot of economic trouble. And it did. It hit tourism really bad. And it's part of what made global oil prices volatile. Peter Kemp of Petroleum Intelligence Weekly in London thinks there may be a momentary euphoria now with oil prices coming down. But he says it's not going to last long. He described the situation this way.
Extremely chaotic still, with a lot of damage in some of the oil fields. There's a chronic shortage of just about everything. So it's going to be many, many, many months before production normalizes.
And he thinks Libya's oil production will still be a third of what it was before the revolution at year's end. He says that's very optimistic.
All right. Well, what about the impact, Mitchell, for Libya's neighbors?
Well, you know, the armed conflict, there's widespread destruction, there was disruption of trade routes and guest workers. It's all had a heavy toll. Egypt had 2 million people working in Libya. A lot of them went home. It made Egypt's unemployment problems even worse. Magda Candle of the Egyptian Center for Economic Studies thinks things now will improve.
We hope that this would provide further avenues for Egypt to capitalize on its proximity to Libya, which is welcome news at a time when the economy remains very weak.
You know, and the U.S. also has to hope Egypt's economy will improve because they're a major ally and aid recipient.
Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman. Thanks, Mitchell.
You're welcome.
Now to Europe. This Sunday is the deadline European leaders have set for themselves to come up with a grand plan to deal with the debt crisis. But this morning, the focus is in Athens, where the Greek parliament is set to vote for a final time on a package of budget cuts and tax increases that are needed for Greece to get more bailout money. Christos Michalidis is a political correspondent at the Athens daily newspaper Elefterotypia. He joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So the controversial budget cuts passed the first hurdle yesterday, just barely in the parliament. What's the mood there in Athens today as the parliament prepares for the final votes?
Well, if we had, according to the police, about 100,000 demonstrators in the center of Athens yesterday outside parliament, it's pretty sure that today we might even have double that number. I've been speaking to many, many people out in the streets. I am with the certainty now that what people are just want is to send a message to the Europeans, to our European colleagues, saying that we are prepared to make some sacrifices, but we feel here in Greece that things have gone a bit too far.
But do the people in Athens realize that they could throw this whole grand plan that's being negotiated for the European debt crisis into trouble if they don't pass these measures?
No, they don't feel that anymore. They believe that they are in a way being blackmailed into this game, that if we do not vote and if we do not support these measures, our country will go bankrupt. People feel that the problem is European and it should be solved at a European level, and that Greece is just a small symptom of the problem.
Christos Michalidis, political correspondent at the Athens daily newspaper Elefterotypia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, the Greek protesters are telling European leaders that the cuts are too much, but those European officials are saying not enough when it comes to the size of the bailout fund. And now France and Germany are reportedly at odds over what to do. Christopher Worth reports from London.
France and Germany are divided over how to magnify the power of the European bailout fund from roughly $600 billion to several trillion dollars. The French want to do that by borrowing from the European Central Bank. Germany is opposed. European leaders have promised to reach an agreement by Sunday, but Andrew Hilton of the CSFI think tank in London says they're already trying to lower expectations.
A couple of weeks ago, this was the key date. Everything was going to be resolved on Sunday. This was the big meeting, and after that, we could all go off into a sunlit future. Now, I think the markets are much more skeptical.
The wider risk if they don't increase the power of the fund is that it won't be large enough to support much bigger countries like Italy and Spain if they should need it. In London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
Next, we go to Thailand, where devastating floods are getting dangerously close to the center of Bangkok. And now there are concerns that the rising waters will have an impact on global business. The BBC's Rachel Harvey joins us now from Bangkok. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, first of all, you've been out and about in the streets. Tell us how bad things are getting with these floods.
Well, the further north you go from Bangkok, the worse it becomes. The central provinces immediately to the north of Bangkok have been really hard hit. We're talking about millions of acres of farmland that are now completely inundated, communities that have been cut off by the floodwaters. In Bangkok itself, the government was saying a few days ago that the capital would be spared, but now they're saying the volume that has built up is so much that they can no longer say that the whole of the capital will be safe. Some parts will inevitably now be flooded. It's a question of how well they might be able to manage the flow of water through the capital city.
And we all remember the huge impact on supply chains around the world after the tsunami in Japan. Is this the kind of thing that could have an impact on business worldwide?
Potentially it could do, particularly in Japan at the moment, because there is a big Japan investment presence here in Thailand, both in the auto industry, in computer industry, and in food processing. And a lot of those firms are based in industrial parks, five of which have now had to be abandoned to the water. And of course, the longer that goes on, the greater the impact that will be had, not just here in Thailand, but regionally and globally. Already, Thailand is talking about possibly a cost in excess of $3 billion and maybe shaving at least a percentage point off GDP for the rest of this year.
Is tourism being affected by this?
Not really yet, but we're about to go into the peak season. Now, part of the reason it hasn't been affected so badly yet is because Bangkok hadn't until this point been hit, and because most of the major tourism kind of beaches and that thing are further south. Thus far, it hasn't had a big impact. If it hits Bangkok, then obviously there will be a short-term impact, but most of the kind of big beach resorts and that kind of thing are further south of here.
The BBC's Rachel Harvey with us from Bangkok. Rachel, thanks.
You're welcome.
Now to some other news. The Labor Department said this morning that the number of people filing for first-time unemployment benefits dropped by 6,000 last week to 403,000, which is still quite high. And we got earnings from Southwest Airlines. The company reported a loss in part because it bought fuel in advance when oil prices were very high. AT&T reported earnings today as well. Profits were less than expected in the third quarter. Sales of iPhones for the company were way down ahead of the new iPhone release. We've got numbers anytime at marketplace.org.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
We'll get earnings today from Microsoft. The company has been getting a bit more aggressive with Apple recently. It hopes to open about 75 Apple-style retail stores in this country in the next few years. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
This Friday, the band The Black Keys is playing a ribbon cutting. Microsoft executives are hoping to create a little buzz around the opening of their newest retail store in Seattle. Jeff Rosters at Gartner Research, he says you could think of these stores as laboratories where Microsoft can study these weird creatures, its customers.
understanding how your products are being used would make any profit or loss almost a rounding error.
In other words, these stores don't have to make money to be a success. If you want to know what a Microsoft store looks like, picture an Apple store and then put the staff in bright colored t-shirts. And there's good reason to imitate Apple. The night Steve Jobs died, I swung by an Apple store in Palo Alto. There was a little memorial outside. But the really striking thing was just how many people were inside shopping.
Right, and it's always that way.
Jeff Green's a retail analyst in Phoenix. He says Apple stores earn more than twice as much cash per square foot than any retail chain in the world.
Apple is a powerhouse.
Microsoft now has a dozen stores in the U.S., but the company has been quiet about how much money they're making. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Well, now to Washington, where a Senate committee is holding a hearing today on the future of the 30-year fixed mortgage. The question is, could it survive if big changes are made to government-backed lenders Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? Here's Marketplace's Adrian Hill.
30-year fixed-rate mortgages let borrowers pay off their homes slowly, with payments that are the same from month to month. They're straightforward. They're vanilla. And says Walter Maloney from the Association of Realtors.
The 30-year fixed-rate mortgage is the lifeblood of the housing industry.
All those exotic loans, all the rage during the housing bubble, are out of favor. Nearly all home loans offered today are long-term fixed-rate mortgages. USC professor Richard Green says there are a couple of reasons for that.
Part of it is the banks are just not that interested in doing the loans. Fannie and Freddie specialize in doing fixed-rate mortgages.
So those are the loans that are getting done. Green says there's also a demand issue.
People are just very afraid. They're looking for safety, and the longer-term mortgage is a safer mortgage.
He thinks the long-term fixed-rate mortgage is important to have as an option. Other shorter-term mortgages have value, too. But he says to improve the housing market, it's not the type of loan that matters so much as making it easier and faster to get it. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Today, about 20,000 water experts are wrapping up a major conference here in Southern California. They've been talking about the water we flush away and how to reuse more of it. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro reports.
If I say designer water, you likely picture an expensive glass bottle at a fancy restaurant, not sewer water. But Shivaji Deshmukh says his sewage treatment plant just south of Los Angeles makes designer water, too.
We're designing the water to fit the needs for our customers.
Those customers range from golf courses to a Chevron refinery that uses the water for cooling towers.
We can do it cheaper than their alternative supply.
And thus, industrial customers help fund the plant. It makes 47 million gallons of water a day by squeezing out waste solids, those can become fertilizer, then chemically treating and filtering the water that's left. Eco-friendly, yes, but the process? Not so pretty.
There's kind of a reddish film on top of this, but when we get to the end of this plant, we're going to have water that we can drink.
That's Matt Reese. He's with the Water Environment Federation. He says wastewater recycling needs better PR to overcome the gross-out factor because it's really just a technological take on the natural water cycle.
We've been doing it forever. The same water here in these tanks is the same water the dinosaurs swam in. We have a finite amount of water on this planet, and it keeps getting recycled and recycled and recycled.
He says we need to recycle more water and faster as global population grows, and charge more for it to fund new infrastructure. Engineers and managers from around the world take notes as they tour the plant.
What's your name and where are you from?
Rodolfo, I'm from Brazil.
At the end, they raise plastic cups.
Here, that's the money card.
And taste sewage made drinkable.
Yeah, it tastes good.
Everyone else agrees, but no plans to bottle it just yet. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Well, now to some news for you 1%ers out there. The Neiman Marcus Christmas catalog is out, and listen to some of these items that are up for sale. For $75,000, you can buy an 18-foot yurt. That's a tent used by nomads. And this one has down pillows and a crystal chandelier. For $425,000, you can buy a flower show tour that'll take you to Switzerland, France, and the UK by private jet, of course. And if you're feeling a little cheap, there's a $5,000 Johnny Walker scotch tasting, which I guess at Neiman Marcus counts as a stocking stuffer. Tonight's game two of the World Series, but many other major league teams are already looking at new prospects to sign over the winter break. And one of the places they'll be looking is the growing baseball powerhouse of Venezuela. Three players from the country will play in the World Series. In today's Midday Extra, we hear from the BBC's Sarah Granger in Caracas, who reports why the country's hardball talent may not be as easily exported in the future.
Venezuelan players' success in the major leagues is partly thanks to training academies set up here to scout and develop talented pitchers and hitters. Since the 1980s, more than a dozen teams built such operations in the baseball-mad country. But now Venezuela's love of the game is being slammed by its aversion to business. The New York Mets, San Diego Padres, and Houston Astros have all recently abandoned their local training camps, blaming anti-business rules from the Marxist government of Hugo Chavez. Detroit Tigers scout Pedro Chavez still works in Venezuela, but says he can understand why other teams have left.
The government makes tougher for the teams. The government makes too many rules, making it a little difficult. And the safety, you know, in the streets is pretty bad.
President Hugo Chavez has nationalized many industries, scaring investors like baseball teams. And now those teams are looking at stealing away to more business-friendly countries like the Dominican Republic. In Caracas, I'm the BBC's Sarah Granger for Marketplace.
Perhaps one of the reasons the Occupy Wall Street protests have picked up so much steam is that almost everyone agrees the middle class is being squeezed in this country. So is there a country that's doing a good job when it comes to building a strong middle class? We asked Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell to look into that, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So is anybody getting it right when it comes to fostering a strong middle class?
Oh, I think there are a number of countries that are truly getting it right. The Northern European countries, Denmark, Sweden, Switzerland, Germany, you know, they're doing it right. They have a healthy middle class. And then there's Canada, Australia, New Zealand. They also have a much more vibrant middle class compared to the U.S.
And what is it that they're doing to get that vibrant middle class?
Well, I think there's a couple things. These are all capitalist economies, but they have a much stronger social safety net. Big difference, for example, every citizen has health care. Another thing that they have is essentially they're fiscally conservative. I mean, I know if you look up past over their history, there have been moments where they haven't been. But it's essentially fiscally conservative societies that pay as they go. They tend to have strong unions. So with strong unions, low-income folks tend to be paid better. Middle managers tend to be paid less.
But how can you have that where you have a strong safety net and also a fiscally conservative government?
Very simple. If you look in U.S. history, Walter Mondale was a fiscal conservative. He lost to Ronald Reagan. But what he argued for is if we're going to have Social Security, if we're going to have Medicare, if we're going to have these social programs, we pay for them. That's what being fiscally conservative means.
But aren't we different, Chris? I mean, we're so much bigger here in the U.S. than, say, Switzerland or Norway. Doesn't that make a difference when it comes to trying to have a strong middle class?
It does, but we're not that different. Look, we're not going to have strong private sector unions in the U.S. I mean, that's what our history tells us. But what we can do is focus government policies and learn from these countries about focusing government policies to boosting the low-income folks in this country.
Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell. Chris, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
And finally, to a new search engine from someone who probably hasn't been Googled in a while. That would be 80s and 90s rapper MC Hammer. At a conference in San Francisco yesterday, Hammer unveiled a new web service called WireDo that's supposed to add related information to search results. So if you search for, say, MC Hammer, you might find links to dance classes or stores that sell parachute pants.
Can't touch this. That word because you know. Touch this.
I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
Break it down.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
Hammer time.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.